Again, the scored hunks disappeared. Kathy stole them and broke them in little pieces. She carried the chips in her apron pocket, and when no one was about, she crushed the soft lime between her teeth. She spoke very little. Her eyes were remote, and it was as though she had gone away, leaving a breathing doll to conceal her absence. Activities surged around her. Adam went happily about building and planning his Eden. Samuel and his boys brought in a well at 40 feet and put down the newfangled, expensive metal casing, for Adam wanted the best. The Hamiltons moved their rig and started another hole. They slept in a tent beside the work and cooked over a campfire. But there was always one or another of them riding home for a tool or with a message. Adam fluttered like a bewildered bee, confused by too many flowers. He sat by Kathy and chatted about the pie plant roots just come in. He sketched for her the new fan blade Samuel had invented for the windmill. It had a variable pitch and was an unheard-of thing. He rode out to the well rig and slowed the work with his interest. And naturally, as he discussed wells with Kathy, his talk was all of birth and child care at the wellhead. It was a good time for Adam. The best time. He was the king of his wide and spacious life, and summer passed into hot and fragrant autumn. The Hamiltons at the well rig had finished their lunch of Liza's bread and rat cheese and venomous coffee cooked in a can over the fire. Joe's eyes were heavy, and he was considering how he could get away into the brush to sleep for a while. Samuel knelt in the sandy soil, looking at the torn and broken edges of his bit. Just before they had stopped for lunch, the drill had found something 30 feet down that had mangled the steel as though it were lead. Samuel scraped the edge of the blade with his pocket knife and inspected the scrapings in the palm of his hand. His eyes shone with a childlike excitement. He held out his hand and poured the scrapings into Tom's hand.
"Take a look at it, son. What do you think it is?"
Joe wandered over from his place in front of the tent. Tom studied the fragments in his hand.
"Whatever it is, it's hard," he said. "Couldn't be a diamond that big. Looks like metal. Do you think we've bored into a buried locomotive?"
His father laughed. 30 feet down," he said admiringly.
"It looks like tool steel," said Tom. "We haven't got anything that can touch it."
Then he saw the faraway, joyous look on his father's face, and a shiver of shared delight came to him. The Hamilton children loved it when their father's mind went free. Then the world was peopled with wonders. Samuel said,
"Metal, you say? You think steel, Tom? I'm going to make a guess, and then I'm going to get an assay. Now hear my guess and remember it. I think we'll find nickel in it, and silver, maybe, and carbon and manganese. How I would like to dig it up. It's in sea sand. That's what we've been getting."
Tom said, "Say, what do you think it is with nickel and silver?"
"It must have been long 1,000 centuries ago," Samuel said, and his sons knew he was seeing it. "Maybe it was all water here. An inland sea with the seabirds circling and crying. And it would have been a pretty thing if it happened at night. There would come a line of light, and then a pencil of white light, and then a tree of blinding light drawn in a long arc from heaven. Then there'd be a great water spout and a big mushroom of steam. And your ears would be staggered by the sound because the soaring cry of it coming would be on you at the same time the water exploded. And then it would be black night again because of the blinding light. And gradually you'd see the killed fish coming up, showing silver in the starlight, and the crying birds would come and eat them. It's a lonely, lovely thing to think about, isn't it?"
He made them see it, as he always did. Tom said softly,
"You think it's a meteorite, don't you?"
"That I do, and we can prove it by assay.
Joe said eagerly, "Let's dig it up."
"You dig it, Joe, while we bore for water."
Tom said seriously, "If the assay showed enough nickel and silver, wouldn't it pay to mine it?"
"You're my own son," said Samuel. "We don't know whether it's as big as a house or as little as a hat."
"But we could probe down and see."
"That we could if we did it secretly and hid our thinking under a pot."
"Why, what do you mean?"
"Now, Tom, have you no kindness toward your mother? We give her enough trouble, son. She's told me plain that if I spend any more money patenting things, she'll give us trouble to remember. Have pity on her. Can't you see her shame when they ask her what we're doing? She's a truthful woman, your mother. She'd have to say, 'They're at digging up a star.'" He laughed happily. "She'd never live it down. And she'd make us smart. No pies for 3 months."
Tom said, "We can't get through it. We'll have to move to another place."
"I'll put some blasting powder down," said his father. "And if that doesn't crack it aside, we'll start a new hole."
He stood up.
"I'll have to go home for powder and to sharpen the drill. Why don't you boys ride along with me, and we'll give Mother a surprise, so that she'll cook the whole night and complain. That way she'll dissemble her pleasure."
Joe said, "Somebody's coming, coming fast." And indeed they could see a horseman riding toward them at full gallop, but a curious horseman who flopped about on his mount like a tied chicken. When he came a little closer, they saw that it was Lee, his elbows waving like wings, his queue lashing about like a snake. It was surprising that he stayed on at all and still drove the horse at full tilt. He pulled up, breathing heavily.
"Missy Adams, say come! Missy Kathy bad! Come quick! Missy yell, scream!"
Samuel said, "Hold on, Lee. When did it start?"
"Maybe breakfast time."
"All right, calm yourself. How is Adam?"
"Missy Adam crazy. Cry, laugh, make vomit."
"Sure," said Samuel. "These new fathers. I was one once. Tom, throw a saddle on for me, will you?"
Joe said, "What is it?"
"Why, Mrs. Trask is about to have her baby. I told Adam I'd stand by."
"You?" Joe asked. Samuel leveled his eyes on his youngest son.
"I brought both of you into the world," he said, "and you've given no evidence you think I did a bad service to the world. Tom, you get all the tools gathered up, and go back to the ranch and sharpen the metal. Bring back the box of powder that's on the shelf in the tool shed, and go easy with it, as you love your arms and legs. Joe, I want you to stay here and look after things."
Joe said plaintively, "But what will I do here alone?" Samuel was silent for a moment. Then he said,
"Joe, do you love me?"
"Why, sure."
"If you heard I'd committed some great crime, would you turn me over to the police?"
"What are you talking about?"
"Would you?"
"No."
"All right, then. In my basket, under my clothes, you'll find 2 books. New, so be gentle with them. It's 2 volumes by a man the world is going to hear from. You can start reading if you want, and it will raise up your lid a little. It's called The Principles of Psychology, and it's by an Eastern man named William James, no relative to the train robber. And, Joe, if you ever let on about the books, I'll run you off the ranch. If your mother ever found out I spent the money on them, she'd run me off the ranch."
Tom led his saddled horse to him. "Can I read it next?"
"Yes," said Samuel, and he slipped his leg lightly over the saddle. "Come on, Lee." The Chinese wanted to break into a gallop, but Samuel restrained him. "Take it easy, Lee. Birthing takes longer than you think, mostly." For a time, they rode in silence, and then Lee said,
"I'm sorry you bought those books. I have the condensed form in 1 volume, the textbook. You could have borrowed it."
"Have you now? Do you have many books?"
"Not many here. 30 or 40. But you're welcome to any of them you haven't read."
"Thank you, Lee. You may be sure I'll look the first moment I can. You know, you could talk to my boys.
Joe's a little flighty, but Tom's all right, and it would do him good.
It's a hard bridge to cross, Mr. Hamilton. Makes me timid to talk to a new person. But I'll try if you say so.
They walked the horses rapidly toward the little draw of the Trask place. Samuel said, "Tell me, how is it with the mother?"
"I'd rather you saw for yourself and thought for yourself," Lee said.
"You know, when a man lives alone as much as I do, his mind can go off on an irrational tangent just because his social world is out of kilter." "Yes, I know. But I'm not lonely, and I'm on a tangent, too. But maybe not the same one."
"You don't think I imagine it, then?"
"I don't know what it is, but I'll tell you for your reassurance that I've a sense of strangeness."
"I guess that's all it is with me, too," said Lee. He smiled. "I'll tell you how far it got with me, though. Since I've come here, I find myself thinking of Chinese fairy tales my father told me. We Chinese have a well-developed demonology."
"You think she's a demon?"
"Of course not," said Lee. "I hope I'm a little beyond such silliness. I don't know what it is.
You know, Mr. Hamilton, a servant develops an ability to taste the wind and judge the climate of the house he works in. And there's a strangeness here. Maybe that's what makes me remember my father's demons." "Did your father believe in them?"
"Oh, no. He thought I should know the background. You Occidentals perpetuate a good many myths, too."
Samuel said, "Tell me what happened to set you off. This morning, I mean."
"If you weren't coming, I would try," said Lee. "But I would rather not. You can see for yourself. I may be crazy. Of course, Mr. Adam is strung so tight he may snap like a banjo string."
"Give me a little hint. It might save time. What did she do?"
"Nothing. That's just it, Mr. Hamilton. I've been at births before, a good many of them. But this is something new to me."
"How?"
Well, I'll tell you the one thing I can think of. This is much more like a bitter, deadly combat than a birth."
As they rode into the draw and under the oak trees, Samuel said, "I hope you haven't got me in a state, Lee. It's a strange day, and I don't know why."
"No wind," said Lee. "It's the first day in a month when there hasn't been wind in the afternoon."
"That's so. You know, I've been so close to the details, I've paid no attention to the clothing of the day. First we find a buried star, and now we go to dig up a mint-new human." He looked up through the oak branches at the yellow-lit hills. "What a beautiful day to be born in," he said. "If signs have fingers on a life, it's a sweet life coming. And Lee, if Adam plays true, he'll be in the way. Stay close, will you, in case I need something? Look, the men, the carpenters, are sitting under that tree."
"Mr. Adams stopped the work. He thought the hammering might disturb his wife."
Samuel said, "You stay close. That sounds like Adam playing true. He doesn't know his wife probably couldn't hear God himself beating a tattoo on the sky." The workman sitting under the tree waved to him.
"How do, Mr. Hamilton? How's your family?"
"Fine, fine.
Say, isn't that Rabbit Holman? Where have you been, Rabbit?"
"Went prospecting, Mr. Hamilton."
"Find anything, Rabbit?"
"Hell, Mr. Hamilton, I couldn't even find the mule I went out with." They rode on toward the house. Lee said quickly,
"If you ever get a minute, I'd like to show you something."
"What is it, Lee?"
"Well, I've been trying to translate some old Chinese poetry into English. I'm not sure it can be done. Will you take a look?"
"I'd like to, Lee. Why, that would be a treat for me."
This ends Disc 7. East of Eden, Disc 8.
Bordoni's white frame house was very quiet, almost broodingly quiet, and the shades were pulled down. Samuel dismounted at the stoop, untied his bulging saddlebags, and gave his horse to Lee. He knocked and got no answer and went in. It was dusky in the living room after the outside light. He looked in the kitchen, scrubbed to the wood grain by Lee. A gray stoneware pilon coffee pot grunted on the back of the stove. Samuel tapped lightly on the bedroom door and went in. It was almost pitch black inside, for not only were the shades down, but blankets were tacked over the windows. Kathy was lying in the big four-poster bed, and Adam sat beside her, his face buried in the coverlet. He raised his head and looked blindly out. Samuel said pleasantly, "Why are you sitting in the dark?" Adam's voice was hoarse.
"She doesn't want the light. It hurts your eyes."
Samuel walked into the room, and authority grew in him with each step.
"There will have to be light," he said. "She can close her eyes. I'll tie a black cloth over them if she wants."
He moved to the window and grasped the blanket to pull it down, but Adam was upon him before he could yank.
"Leave it! The light hurts her," he said fiercely.
Samuel turned on him. "Now, Adam, I know what you feel. I promised you I'd take care of things, and I will. I only hope one of those things isn't you." He pulled the blanket down and rolled up the shade to let the golden afternoon light in. Kathy made a little mewing sound from the bed, and Adam went to her.
"Close your eyes, dear. I'll put a cloth over your eyes."
Samuel dropped his saddlebags in a chair and stood beside the bed. "Adam," he said firmly, "I'm going to ask you to go out of the room and to stay out."
"No, I can't. Why?"
"Because I don't want you in the way. It's considered a sweet practice for you to get drunk."
"I couldn't."
Samuel said, "Anger's a slow thing in me, and disgust is slower, but I can taste the beginnings of both of them. You'll get out of the room and give me no trouble, or I'll go away, and you'll have a basket of trouble."
Adam went, finally, and from the doorway Samuel called, "And I don't want you busting in if you hear anything. You wait for me to come out." He closed the door, noticed there was a key in the lock, and turned it.
"He's an upset, vehement man," he said. "He loves you."
He hadn't looked at her closely until now, and he saw true hatred in her eyes, unforgiving, murderous hatred.
"It'll be over before long, dearie. Now, tell me, has the water broke?"
Her hostile eyes glared at him, and her lips raised, snarling from her little teeth. She didn't answer him. He stared at her.
"I didn't come by choice except as a friend," he said. "It's not a pleasure to me, young woman. I don't know your trouble, and minute by minute I don't care. Maybe I can save you some pain, who knows? I'm going to ask you one more question. If you don't answer, if you put that snarling look on me, I'm going out and leave you to welter."
The words struck into her understanding like lead shot dropped in water. She made a great effort, and it gave him a shivering to see her face change, the steel leave her eyes, the lips thicken from line to bow, and the corners turn up. He noticed a movement of her hands, the fists unclench, and the fingers turn pinkly upward. Her face became young and innocent and bravely hurt. It was like one magic lantern slide taking the place of another. She said softly, "The water broke at dawn."
"That's better. Have you had hard labor?"
"Yes."
"How far apart?"
"I don't know."
"Well, I've been in this room 15 minutes.
I've had 2 little ones. No big ones since you came."
"Fine. Now, where's your linen?"
"In that hamper over there."
"You'll be all right, dearie," he said gently.
He opened his saddlebags and took out a thick rope covered with blue velvet and looped at either end. On the velvet, hundreds of little pink flowers were embroidered. Liza sent you her pulling robe to use, he said. She made it when our firstborn was preparing. What with our children and friends, this rope has pulled a great number of people into the world. He slipped one of the loops over each of the footposts of the bed. Suddenly her eyes glazed, and her back arched like a spring, and the blood started to her cheeks. He waited for her to cry or scream, and looked apprehensively at the closed door. But there was no scream, only a series of grunting squeals. After a few seconds, her body relaxed, and the hatefulness was back in her face. The labor struck again. "There's a deer," he said soothingly. "Was it one or two? I don't know. The more you see, the more you learn no two are alike. I'd better get my hands washed." Her head thrashed from side to side. "Good, good, my darling," he said. "I think it won't be long till your baby's here." He put his hand on her forehead where her scars showed dark and angry. "How did you get the hurt on your head?" he asked. Her head jerked up, and her sharp teeth fastened on his hand across the back and up into the palm near the little finger. He cried out in pain and tried to pull his hand away, but her jaw was set, and her head twisted and turned, mangling his hand the way a terrier worries a sack. A shrill snarling came from her set teeth. He slapped her on the cheek, and it had no effect. Automatically, he did what he would have done to stop a dogfight. His left hand went to her throat, and he cut off her wind. She struggled and tore at his hand before her jaws unclenched, and he pulled his hand free. The flesh was torn and bleeding. He stepped back from the bed and looked at the damage her teeth had done. He looked at her with fear. And when he looked, her face was calm again, and young and innocent. "I'm sorry," she said quickly. "Oh, I'm sorry." Samuel shuddered. "It was the pain," she said. Samuel laughed shortly. "I'll have to muzzle you, I guess," he said. "A collie bitch did the same to me once." He saw the hatred look out of her eyes for a second, and then retreat. Samuel said, "Have you got anything to put on it? Humans are more poisonous than snakes." "I don't know." "Well, have you got any whiskey? I'll pour some whiskey on it." "In the second drawer." He splashed whiskey on his bleeding hand and kneaded the flesh against the alcohol sting. A strong quaking was in his stomach, and a sickness rose up against his eyes. He took a swallow of whiskey to steady himself. He dreaded to look back at the bed. "My hand won't be much good for a while," he said. Samuel told Adam afterward, "She must be made of whalebone. The birth happened before I was ready. Popped like a seed. I'd not water ready to wash him. Why, she didn't even touch the pulling rope to bear down. Pure whalebone she is." He tore at the door, called Lee, and demanded warm water. Adam came charging into the room. "A boy," Samuel cried. "You got a boy." "Easy," he said, for Adam had seen the mess in the bed and a green was rising in his face. Samuel said, "Send Lee in here. And you, Adam, if you still have the authority to tell your hands and feet what to do, get to the kitchen and make me some coffee. And see the lamps are filled and the chimneys clean." Adam turned like a zombie and left the room. In a moment, Lee looked in. Samuel pointed to the bundle in the laundry basket. "Sponge him off in warm water, Lee. Don't let a draft get on him. Lord, I wish Liza were here. I can't do everything at once." He turned back to the bed. "Now, dearie, I'll get you cleaned up." Kathy was bowed again, snarling in her pain. "It'll be over in a little," he said. "Takes a little time for the residue. And you're so quick. Well, you didn't even have to pull on Liza's rope." He saw something, stared, and went quickly to work. "Lord God in heaven, it's another one!" He worked fast, and as with the first, the birth was incredibly quick. And again Samuel tied the cord. Lee took the second baby, washed it, wrapped it, and put it in the basket. Samuel cleaned the mother and shifted her gently while he changed the linen on the bed. He found in himself a reluctance to look in her face. He worked as quickly as he could, for his bitten hand was stiffening. He drew a clean white sheet up to her chin and raised her to slip a fresh pillow under her head. At last he had to look at her. Her golden hair was wet with perspiration, but her face had changed. It was stony, expressionless. At her throat, the pulse fluttered visibly.
"You have two sons," Samuel said. "Two fine sons. They aren't alike, each one born separate in his own sack."
She inspected him coldly and without interest. Samuel said,
"I'll show your boys to you."
"No," she said, without emphasis.
"Now, dearie, don't you want to see your sons?"
"No, I don't want them."
"Oh, you'll change. You're tired now, but you'll change. And I'll tell you now, this birth was quicker and easier than I've seen ever in my life."
The eyes moved from his face. "I don't want them. I want you to cover the windows and take the light away."
"It's weariness. In a few days you'll feel so different you won't remember."
"I'll remember. Go away. Take them out of the room. Send Adam in." Samuel was caught by her tone. There was no sickness, no weariness, no softness. His words came out without his will.
"I don't like you," he said, and wished he could gather the words back into his throat and into his mind.
But his words had no effect on Kathy. "Send Adam in," she said. In the little living room, Adam looked vaguely at his sons and went quickly into the bedroom and shut the door. In a moment came the sound of tapping. Adam was nailing the blankets over the windows again. Lee brought coffee to Samuel. "That's a bad-looking hand you have there," he said.
"I know. I'm afraid it's going to give me trouble."
"Why did she do it?"
"I don't know. She's a strange thing."
Lee said, "Mr. Hamilton, let me take care of that. You could lose an arm." The life went out of Samuel.
"Do what you want, Lee. A frightened sorrow has closed down over my heart. I wish I were a child so I could cry. I'm too old to be afraid like this. And I have not felt such despair since a bird died in my hand by a flowing water long ago."
Lee left the room and shortly returned, carrying a small ebony box carved with twisting dragons. He sat by Samuel and from his box took a wedge-shaped Chinese razor. "It will hurt," he said softly.
"I'll try to bear it, Lee."
The Chinese bit his lips, feeling the inflicted pain in himself while he cut deeply into the hand, opened the flesh around the tooth marks front and back, and trimmed the ragged flesh away until good red blood flowed from every wound. He shook a bottle of yellow emulsion labeled Hall's Cream Salve and poured it into the deep cuts. He saturated a handkerchief with the salve and wrapped the hand. Samuel winced and gripped the chair arm with his good hand. "It's mostly carbolic acid," Lee said. "You can smell it."
"Thank you, Lee. I'm being a baby to knot up like this."
"I don't think I could have been so quiet," said Lee. "I'll get you another cup of coffee." He came back with two cups and sat down by Samuel. "I think I'll go away," he said. "I never went willingly to a slaughterhouse." Samuel stiffened.
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know. The words came out." Samuel shivered.
"Lee, men are fools. I guess I hadn't thought about it, but Chinese men are fools, too."
"What made you doubt it?" No, oh, maybe because we think of strangers as stronger and better than we are. What do you want to say? Samuel said, maybe the foolishness is necessary. The dragon fighting, the boasting, the pitiful courage to be constantly knocking a chip off God's shoulder, and the childish cowardice that makes a ghost of a dead tree beside a darkening road. Maybe that's good and necessary, but... What do you want to say? Lee repeated patiently. I thought some wind had blown up the embers in my foolish mind, Samuel said. And now I hear in your voice that you have it too. I feel wings over this house. I feel a dreadfulness coming. I feel it too. I know you do. And that makes me take less than my usual comfort in my foolishness. This birth was too quick, too easy, like a cat having kittens. And I fear for those kittens. I have dreadful thoughts gnawing to get into my brain. What do you want to say? Lee asked a third time. I want my wife, Samuel cried. No dreams, no ghosts, no foolishness. I want her here. They say miners take canaries into the pits to test the air. Liza has no truck with foolishness. And Lee, if Liza sees a ghost, it's a ghost and not a fragment of a dream. If Liza feels trouble, we'll bar the doors. Lee got up and went to the laundry basket and looked down at the babies. He had to peer close, for the light was going fast. They're sleeping, he said. They'll be squalling soon enough. Lee, will you hitch up the rig and drive to my place for Liza? Tell her I need her here. If Tom's still there, tell him to mind the place. If not, I'll send him in the morning. And if Liza doesn't want to come, tell her we need a woman's hand here and a woman's clear eyes. She'll know what you mean. I'll do it, said Lee. Maybe we're scaring each other, like two children in the dark. I've thought of that, Samuel said. And Lee, tell her I hurt my hand at the wellhead. Do not, for God's sake, tell her how it happened. I'll get some lamps lit and then I'll go, said Lee. It will be a great relief to have her here. That it will, Lee, that it will. She'll let some light into this cellar hole. After Lee drove away in the dark, Samuel picked up a lamp in his left hand. He had to set it on the floor to turn the knob of the bedroom door. The room was in pitch blackness, and the yellow lamplight streamed upward and did not light the bed. Kathy's voice came strong and edged from the bed. Shut the door. I don't want the light. Adam, go out. I want to be in the dark, alone. Adam said hoarsely, I want to stay with you. I don't want you. I will stay. Then stay, but don't talk anymore. Please close the door and take the lamp away. Samuel went back to the living room. He put the lamp on the table by the laundry basket and looked in on the small sleeping faces of the babies. Their eyes were pinched shut, and they sniffled a little in discomfort at the light. Samuel put his forefinger down and stroked the hot foreheads. One of the twins opened his mouth and yawned prodigiously and settled back to sleep. Samuel moved the lamp and went to the front door and opened it and stepped outside. The evening star was so bright that it seemed to flare and crumple as it sank toward the western mountains. The air was still, and Samuel could smell the day-heated sage. The night was very dark. Samuel started when he heard a voice speaking out of the blackness. How is she? Who is it? Samuel demanded. It's me, Rabbit. The man emerged and took form in the light from the doorway. The mother, Rabbit? Oh, she's fine. Lee said twins. That's right, twin sons. You couldn't want better. I guess Mr. Trask will tear the river up by the roots now. He'll bring in a crop of candy canes. Samuel didn't know why he changed the subject. Rabbit, you know what we bored into today? A meteorite. What's that, Mr. Hamilton? A shooting star that fell a million years ago. You did? Well, think of that. How did you hurt your hand? I almost set on a shooting star, Samuel laughed. But it wasn't that interesting. I pinched it in the tackle. Bad? No, not bad. Two boys, said Rabbit. My old lady will be jealous. Will you come inside and sit, Rabbit? No, thank you. I'll get out to sleep. Morning seems to come earlier every year I live. That it does, Rabbit. Good night, then. Liza Hamilton arrived about 4 a.m. Samuel was asleep in his chair, dreaming that he had gripped a red-hot bar of iron and couldn't let go. Liza awakened him and looked at his hand before she even glanced at the babies. While she did well the things he had done in a lumbering, masculine way, she gave him his orders and packed him off. He was to get up this instant, saddle Doxology, and ride straight to King City. No matter what time it was, he must wake up that good-for-nothing doctor and get his hand treated. If it seemed all right, he could go home and wait. And it was a criminal thing to leave your last born, and he little more than a baby himself, sitting there by a hole in the ground with no one to care for him. It was a matter which might even engage the attention of the Lord God himself. If Samuel craved realism and activity, he got it. She had him off the place by dawn. His hand was bandaged by 11, and he was in his own chair at his own table by 5 p.m, sizzling with fever. And Tom was boiling a hen to make chicken soup for him. For 3 days, Samuel lay in bed, fighting the fever phantoms and putting names to them, too, before his great strength broke down the infection and drove it caterwauling away. Samuel looked up at Tom with clear eyes and said, "I'll have to get up," tried it, and sat weakly back, chuckling, the sound he made when any force on the world defeated him. He had an idea that even when beaten, he could steal a little victory by laughing at defeat. And Tom brought him chicken soup until he wanted to kill him. The lore hasn't died out of the world, and you will still find people who believe that soup will cure any hurt or illness, and is no bad thing to have for the funeral, either. Liza stayed away a week. She cleaned the Trask house from the top clear down into the grain of the wooden floors. She washed everything she could bend enough to get into a tub and sponged the rest. She put the babies on a working basis and noted with satisfaction that they howled most of the time and began to gain weight. Lee she used as a slave, since she didn't quite believe in him. Adam she ignored, since she couldn't use him for anything. She did make him wash the windows, and then did it again after he had finished. Liza sat with Kathy just enough to come to the conclusion that she was a sensible girl who didn't talk very much or try to teach her grandmother to suck eggs. She also checked her over and found that she was perfectly healthy, not injured and not sick, and that she would never nurse the twins. "And just as well, too," she said. "Those great lummoxes would chew a little thing like you to the bone." She forgot that she was smaller than Kathy and had nursed every one of her own children. On Saturday afternoon, Liza checked her work, left a list of instructions as long as her arm to cover every possibility, from colic to an inroad of grease ants, packed her traveling basket, and had Lee drive her home. She found her house a stable of filth and abomination, and she set to cleaning it with a violence and disgust of a Hercules at labor. Samuel asked questions of her in flight. "How are the babies?" "They were fine, growing." "How was Adam?" "Well, he moved around as if he was alive, but he left no evidence. The Lord, in his wisdom, gave money to very curious people, perhaps because they'd starve without." "How was Mrs. Trask?" "Quiet, lackadaisical, like most rich Eastern women." Liza had never known a rich Eastern woman. But on the other hand, docile and respectful. "And it's a strange thing," Liza said. "I can find no real fault with her, save perhaps a touch of laziness. And yet, I don't like her very much. Maybe it's that scar. How did she get it?"
"I don't know," said Samuel.
Liza leveled her forefinger like a pistol between his eyes. "I'll tell you something. Unbeknownst to herself, she's put a spell on her husband. He moons around her like a sick duck. I don't think he's given the twins a thorough good look yet." Samuel waited until she went by again. He said, "Well, if she's lazy and he's moony, who's going to take care of the sweet babies? Twin boys take a piece of looking after." Liza stopped in mid-swoop, drew a chair close to him, and sat, resting her hands on her knees. "Remember, I've never held the truth lightly, if you don't believe me," she said.
"I don't think you could lie, dearie," he said,
and she smiled, thinking it a compliment.
"Well, what I'm to tell you might weigh a little heavy on your belief, if you didn't know that."
"Tell me." "Samuel, you know that Chinese with his slanty eyes and his outlandish talk and that braid?"
"Lee? Sure, I know him."
"Well, wouldn't you say offhand he was a heathen?"
"I don't know."
"Come now, Samuel, anybody would."
"But he's not."
She straightened up.
"What is he?"
She tapped his arm with an iron finger.
"A Presbyterian? And well up. Well up, I say, when you dig it out of that crazy talk. Now, what do you think of that?"
Samuel's voice was unsteady, with trying to clamp his laughter in.
"No," he said.
"And I say yes. Well, now, who do you think is looking after the twins?
I wouldn't trust a heathen from here to Omega, but a Presbyterian. He learned everything I told him."
"No wonder they're taking on weight," said Samuel.
"It's a matter for praise, and it's a matter for prayer."
"We'll do it, too," said Samuel. "Both." For a week, Kathy rested and gathered her strength. On Saturday of the second week of October, she stayed in her bedroom all morning. Adam tried the door and found it locked.
"I'm busy," she called, and he went away.
Putting her bureau in order, he thought, for he could hear her opening drawers and closing them. In the late afternoon, Lee came to Adam where he sat on the stoop.
"Missy say I go King City, buy nursey bottle," he said uneasily.
"Well, do it then," said Adam. "She's your mistress."
"Missy say not come back maybe Monday. Take..."
Kathy spoke calmly from the doorway. "He hasn't had a day off for a long time. A rest would do him good."
"Of course," said Adam. "I just didn't think of it. Have a good time. If I need anything, I'll get one of the carpenters."
"Men go home, Sunday."
"I'll get the Indian. Lopez will help."
Lee felt Kathy's eyes on him.
"Lopez drunk. Find bottle whiskey."
Adam said petulantly, "I'm not helpless, Lee. Stop arguing." Lee looked at Kathy standing in the doorway. He lowered his eyelids.
"Maybe I come back late," he said.
And he thought he saw two dark lines appear between her eyes and then disappear. He turned away.
"Goodbye,"
he said. Kathy went back to her room as the evening came down. At 7:30, Adam knocked.
"I've got you some supper, dear. It's not much."
The door opened as though she had been standing, waiting. She was dressed in her neat traveling dress, the jacket edged in black braid, black velvet lapels, and large jet buttons. On her head was a wide straw hat with a tiny crown. Long jet-beaded hatpins held it on. Adam's mouth dropped open. She gave him no chance to speak.
"I'm going away now."
"Kathy, what do you mean?"
"I told you before."
"You didn't." You didn't listen. It doesn't matter. I don't believe you. Her voice was dead and metallic. I don't give a damn what you believe. I'm going.
The babies?
Throw them in one of your wells. He cried in panic.
Kathy, you're sick. You can't go. Not from me. Not from me.
I can do anything to you. Any woman can do anything to you. You're a fool. The word got through his haze. Without warning, his hands reached for her shoulders and he thrust her backward. As she staggered, he took the key from the inside of the door, slammed the door shut, and locked it. He stood panting, his ear close to the panel, and a hysterical sickness poisoned him. He could hear her moving quietly about. A drawer was opened, and the thought leaped in him, she's going to stay. And then there was a little click he couldn't place. His ear was almost touching the door. Her voice came from so near that he jerked his head back. He heard richness in her voice.
Dear, she said softly, I didn't know you would take it so. I'm sorry, Adam.
His breath burst hoarsely out of his throat. His hand trembled, trying to turn the key, and it fell out on the floor after he had turned it. He pushed the door open. She stood 3 feet away. In her right hand, she held his .44 caliber Colt, and the black hole in the barrel pointed at him. He took a step toward her, saw that the hammer was back. She shot him. The heavy slug struck him in the shoulder and flattened and tore out a piece of his shoulder blade. The flash and roar smothered him, and he staggered back and fell to the floor. She moved slowly toward him, cautiously, as she might toward a wounded animal. He stared up into her eyes, which inspected him impersonally. She tossed the pistol on the floor beside him and walked out of the house. He heard her steps on the porch, on the crisp, dry oak leaves on the path, and then he could hear her no more. And the monotonous sound that had been there all along was the cry of the twins, wanting their dinner. He had forgotten to feed them. Chapter 18. Horace Quinn was the new deputy sheriff, appointed to look after things around the King City district. He complained that his new job took him away from his ranch too much. His wife complained even more, but the truth of the matter was that nothing much had happened in a criminal way since Horace had been deputy. He had seen himself making a name for himself and running for sheriff. The sheriff was an important officer. His job was less flighty than that of the district attorney, almost as permanent and dignified as superior court judge. Horace didn't want to stay on the ranch all his life, and his wife had an urge to live in Salinas, where she had relatives. When the rumors, repeated by the Indian and the carpenters, that Adam Trask had been shot, reached Horace, he saddled up right away and left his wife to finish butchering the pig he had killed that morning. Just north of the big sycamore tree where the Hester Road turns off to the left, Horace met Julius Uscotti. Julius was trying to decide whether to go quail hunting or to King City and catch the train to Salinas to shake some of the dust out of his britches. The Uscottis were well-to-do, handsome people of Basque extraction. Julius said, if you'd come along with me, I'd go into Salinas. They tell me that right next door to Jenny's, two doors from the Long Green, there's a new place called Fay's. I heard it was pretty nice, run like San Francisco. They got a piano player. Horace rested his elbow on his saddle horn and stirred a fly from his horse's shoulder with his rawhide quirt. Some other time, he said. I gotta look into something. You wouldn't be going to the Trasks, would you? That's right. Did you hear anything about it? Not to make any sense. I heard Mr. Trask shot himself in the shoulder with a .44 and then fired everybody on the ranch. How do you go about shooting yourself in the shoulder with a .44, Horace?
I don't know. Them Easterners are pretty clever. I thought I'd go up and find out. Didn't his wife just have a baby? Twins, I heard, said Julius. Maybe they shot him. One hold the gun, the other pull the trigger. Hear anything else? All mixed up, Horace. Want some company? I'm not going to deputize you, Julius. Sheriff says the supervisors are raising hell about the payroll. Hornby, out in the Alisal, deputized his great aunt and kept her in posse 3 weeks just before Easter.
You're fooling.
No, I'm not. And you get no star. Hell, I don't want to be a deputy. Just thought I'd ride along with you for company. I'm curious. Me too. I'm glad to have you, Julius. I can always fling the oath around your neck if there's any trouble. What do you say the new place is called?
Faye's. Sacramento woman.
They do things pretty nice in Sacramento. And Horace told how they did things in Sacramento as they rode along. It was a nice day to be riding. As they turned into the Sanchez Draw, they were cursing the bad hunting in recent years. Three things are never any good. Farming, fishing, and hunting. Compared to other years, that is. Julius was saying, Christ, I wish they hadn't killed off all the grizzly bears. In 1880, my grandfather killed one up by Plato weighing 1,800 pounds. A silence came on them as they rode in under the oaks, a silence they took from the place itself. There was no sound, no movement. I wonder if he finished fixing up the old house, Horace said. Hell no. Rabbit Holman was working on it, and he told me Trask called them all in and fired them. Told them not to come back. They say Trask has got a pot of money. I guess he's well fixed, all right, said Julius. Sam Hamilton is sinking four wells, if he didn't get fired, too. How is Mr. Hamilton? I ought to go up and see him.
He's fine. Full of hell as ever.
I'll have to go up and pay him a visit, said Horace. Lee came out on the stoop to meet them. Horace said, Hello, Ching Chong. Bossy man here.
He's sick, said Lee.
I'd like to see him.
Merci. He's sick.
That's enough of that, said Horace. Tell him Deputy Sheriff Quinn wants to see him. Lee disappeared, and in a moment he was back.
You come, he said. I take Hossie.
Adam lay on the four-poster bed where the twins had been born. He was propped high with pillows, and a mound of home-devised bandages covered his left breast and shoulder. The room reeked of Hall's cream salve. Horace said later to his wife, And if you ever saw death still breathing, there it was. Adam's cheeks hugged the bone and pulled the skin of his nose tight and slimy. His eyes seemed to bulge out of his head and to take up the whole upper part of his face, and they were shiny with sickness, intense and myopic. His bony right hand needed a fistful of coverlet. Horace said,
Howdy, Mr. Trask. Heard you got hurt.
He paused, waiting for an answer. He went on.
Just thought I'd drop around and see how you were doing. How'd it happen?
A look of transparent eagerness came over Adam's face. He shifted slightly in the bed.
If it hurts to talk, you can whisper, Horace added helpfully.
Only when I breathe deep, Adam said softly. I was cleaning my gun and it went off.
Horace glanced at Julius and then back. Adam saw the look and a little color of embarrassment rose in his cheeks.
It happens all the time, said Horace. Got the gun around?
I think Lee put it away.
Horace stepped to the door.
Hey there, Ching Chong, bring the pistol.
In a moment, Lee poked the gun butt first through the door. Horace looked at it, swung the cylinder out, poked the cartridges out, and smelled the empty brass cylinder of the one empty shell.
There's better shooting cleaning the damn things than pointing them. I'll have to make a report to the county, Mr. Trask. I won't take up much of your time. You were cleaning the barrel, maybe with a rod, and the gun went off and hit you in the shoulder?
That's right, sir. Adam said quickly. And cleaning it, you hadn't swung out the cylinder?
That's right.
And you were poking the rod in and out with the barrel pointed toward you with the hammer cocked. Adam's breath rasped in a quick intake. Horace went on. And it must have blowed the rod right through you and took off your left hand, too. Horace's pale, sun-washed eyes never left Adam's face. He said kindly, "What happened, Mr. Trask? Tell me what happened."
"I tell you truly, it was an accident, sir."
"Now, you wouldn't have me write a report like I just said. The sheriff would think I was crazy. What happened?"
"Well, I'm not very used to guns. Maybe it wasn't just like that, but I was cleaning it and it went off."
There was a whistle in Horace's nose. He had to breathe through his mouth to stop it. He moved slowly up from the foot of the bed, nearer to Adam's head and staring eyes. "You came from the east not very long ago, didn't you, Mr. Trask?"
"That's right. Connecticut."
"I guess people don't use guns very much there anymore."
"Not much."
"Little hunting?"
"Some."
"So you'd be more used to a shotgun."
"That's right. But I never hunted much."
"I guess you didn't hardly use a pistol at all, so you didn't know how to handle it."
"That's right," Adam said eagerly. "Hardly anybody there has a pistol."
"So when you came here, you bought that .44 because everybody out here has a pistol and you were going to learn how to use it."
"Well, I thought it might be a good thing to learn."
Julius Euscotti stood tensely, his face and body receptive, listening but uncommunicative. Horace sighed and looked away from Adam. His eyes brushed over and past Julius and came back to his hands. He laid the gun on the bureau and carefully lined the brass and lead cartridges beside it. "You know," he said, "I've only been a deputy a little while. I thought I was going to have some fun with it and maybe in a few years run for sheriff. I haven't got the guts for it. It isn't any fun to me." Adam watched him nervously. "I don't think anybody's ever been afraid of me before. Mad at me, yes, but not afraid. It's a mean thing. Makes me feel mean." Julia said irritably,
"Get to it. You can't resign right this minute."
"The hell I can't, if I want to." "All right, Mr. Trask, you served in the United States Cavalry. The weapons of the cavalry are carbines and pistols. You..." He stopped and swallowed. "What happened, Mr. Trask?" Adam's eyes seemed to grow larger, and they were moist and edged with red.
"It was an accident," he whispered.
"Anybody see it? Was your wife with you when it happened?" Adam didn't reply, and Horace saw that his eyes were closed. "Mr. Trask," he said, "I know you're a sick man. I'm trying to make it as easy on you as I can. Why don't you rest now while I have a talk with your wife?" He waited a moment and then turned to the doorway where Lee still stood. "Ching Chong, tell Missy I would admire to talk to her a few minutes." Lee didn't reply. Adam spoke without opening his eyes. "My wife is away on a visit."
"She wasn't here when it happened?"
Horace glanced at Julius and saw a curious expression on Julius's lips. The corners of his mouth were turned slightly up in a sardonic smile. Horace thought quickly, "He's ahead of me. He'd make a good sheriff."
"Say," he said, "that's kind of interesting. Your wife had a baby, two babies, 2 weeks ago, and now she's gone on a visit? Did she take the babies with her? I thought I heard him a little while ago."
Horace leaned over the bed and touched the back of Adam's clenched right hand.
"I hate this, but I can't stop now, Trask," he said loudly. "I want you to tell me what happened. This isn't nosiness. This is the law. Now, damn it, you open your eyes and you tell me, or by Christ, I'll take you to the sheriff, even if you're hurt."
Adam opened his eyes and they were blank, like a sleepwalker's eyes. And his voice came out without rise or fall, without emphasis, and without any emotion. It was as though he pronounced perfectly words in a language he did not understand.
"My wife went away," he said.
"Where did she go?"
"I don't know."
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know where she went."
Julius broke in, speaking.